Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured, previously the Emerge One Firesides, but we've decided that, you know, we're going to just flip this whole thing into a podcast. Today, I, Arish Shah, founder of Emerge One and Projected, am here with Tara Reddy, who is co-founder and CEO of Love Shark, which is a venture that is focused on developing AR camera games, especially for teenage girls. Really, really wonderful to have you here with us, Tara. Whereabouts are you at the moment?
I am in London in my spare room.
London in the spare room. Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going around at the moment. We are recording this just at the cusp of the July 2021 Freedom Day celebrations coming up in a couple of weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how all that pans out. But let's not get too stuck on that sort of stuff. I really am very keen to understand more about you, Love Shark, and your journey. So the first thing I wanted to touch on was that you've had a really kind of atypical journey. I'm sure you've talked about this a million and one times, but you know, for our audience, you know, you were originally trained as a vet, and then headed out to New Zealand, then came back into the UK, and then progressed on to develop this passion and love for gaming and for development and for founding your own business. So, what drove all of that? How did that journey kind of evolve? It'd be great to understand.
So, I spent 5 years in uni studying veterinary medicine, and then I went off to New Zealand to work out there, and I spent 6 years working as a vet. So that's 11 years in total dedicated to one industry, basically trained as a vocation. You know, I only really knew how to do one thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, after all those years, I started to feel a little bit unsatisfied in the work. And it was a bit hard to, at the time, I kind of thought, oh my God, am I going through some sort of like quarter life crisis? Like, why is this not working for me? I always wanted this. But like what I sort of realized probably in hindsight is I just wanted to do something that was more creative, something where you had the ability to like make changes and do it fast and experiment. And the medical industry is just not the place for that sort of mentality. You know, it's about doing things by the book, taking things extremely slow and essentially towing the line and, you know, staying in place and doing your job. And that is just not the sort of person that I am. So, you know, after 6 years of sort of being confined in a little consult room and in a little veterinary practice, which was a, you know, wonderful industry and great to work with animals and lovely people. But I kind of knew like this is not going to work for me. I still have so many years of my career. I'm going to need to find, you know, something else. I had no idea what to do. I started Googling business courses online because I felt like I needed to understand the world of business. I literally didn't know I didn't know what revenue was. I didn't know what IPO was. I'd been so sheltered in my sort of scientific veterinary world. And one night when I was Googling business courses, I found out about this thing called an MBA, which I'd literally never heard of before. And I was just like, oh, that sounds so interesting. You know, it's global, it's international, it's diverse. And, you know, all the buzzwords that they put on these like admissions websites. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm going to give that a go. So within 6 months, I'd basically, you know, done my exams, gotten in and packed up and flown back to the UK and started my MBA. And I kind of knew there was the consulting and finance offer, but that was not going to work for me. And I wasn't a corporate person. So I was like, well, tech kind of seems like the place that might work. So on my first day of my MBA, I rocked up to a tech startup for an interview wearing a suit because I thought that's what you wore.
Excellent.
I thought that's what business people wore. Yeah. And basically was asking them, can you give me an internship? I just want to be here. I just want to learn. And they did. So I started, you know, interning from day one of my MBA, like in the tech world, and starting to learn a bit about what actually, you know, happens there. And eventually, you know, that turned, as I got through my MBA, I went to join Blipper, which was, you know, one of the AR unicorns of the time. Huge, you know, growth startup, amazing place to learn, focused on augmented reality. And then eventually after a few years there, I was like, okay, I'm ready to start my own thing. And then that's what I did.
And away you go. I mean, like, so there's like an incredibly interesting story. The thing that strikes me is, well, there's two things that struck me actually as you were talking. So first, I think there's a lot of people, you know, certainly that I've come across that have gone through this path because, you know, here in the UK, you effectively are deciding what you're going to do at the age of 14, 15, because that's when you start selecting kind of the sort of subjects you're going to take, and then university, et cetera, follows from there. And there's a lot of people, I think, especially in the professions, lawyers, doctors, accountants, etc., that I've come across over the course of the last 5, 6, 7 years, who feel almost like a little bit trapped in what they're doing, right? For very similar reasons. They're like, did this thing, it was a really passionate reason for doing it initially. But then as they got into it, they kind of maybe got a little bit ground down, or maybe just didn't feel that it was fulfilling that passion anymore. And I think having that courage to flip out, as you say, after 11 years is like, I mean, you know, not for everyone for sure. And I think a really, really, really incredible thing to have done. But the other thing that struck me was, if you think about your kind of comment there, that it was very slow to change within that kind of medical industry, think about today or the last year, where we've had just this massive, massive acceleration within medicine, right? I mean, like, it just strikes me that, you know, maybe had you come into it last year or the year before, you may have had a different attitude altogether. But the other thing I think that I'd really love to kind of dig into is, you know, you kind of said it almost a little bit flippantly after Blipper, you're like, okay, it's time for me to start my own startup. But founding a business is tough at the best of times, right? You've gone from, you know, from effectively a background of a very professional sort of background where you were doing, as you said, the same thing. You then, you know, you did the MBA and the internship and then Blipper. But to move from there to founding your own startup, what drove that? What was the kind of inspiration point for that? And equally, what were the challenges that you had to kind of mentally debate with yourself before actually kind of taking the plunge?
So I think, like, working at Blipper, I met my co-founder there. So Sam is an engineer and I was a product manager. And we were like this little product dream team. So we would get put on projects together and we would, you know, make them super fast with a bit of magic. And that went down really well. So we were always this sort of like very tight little product team. So that was one of the best parts of, you know, working there, is just actually meeting someone who you work so well with, and you get years to actually try out and test that working relationship.
Yeah.
But Sam and I always felt that there was a really big opportunity to utilize the technologies, so like AR and machine learning in games. And we were just like watching the ecosystem and seeing what was coming out and seeing the same old sort of rubbish coming out, you know, over and over again. And we sort of realized, we were like, oh, the people that are making this are all developers who are really passionate about tech. But actually for us, like, we love like building for an audience and delighting people. So we kind of, I guess a switch kind of flicked. That was like, our motivation is different and we think that our process is different and we're going to approach this problem in a different way. So I guess like that was sort of, I guess, like the rationale for us saying, no, we can do this better. Let's give it a try. But I also think like, I just always been a person that's a bit of a pain in the ass to manage. Like, I feel sorry for all my managers over the years. And I do get a bit like frustrated when things can't move as fast as I want to and I can't have the autonomy. And I think, like, you know, every job I like ever had, I always reached that ceiling. And I guess I reached it, you know, at the age of like, what, 32 again. And then I was like, do you know what? This is going to keep happening. I think I need to go and start something. Otherwise, I'm just going to, you know, move to something else and piss off another manager. So, like, it's time for me to steer the ship now. So I guess I eventually felt ready. And yeah, there was also that thing of like being a bit tired of having to always report into someone and wanting that autonomy.
Yeah, so I completely get it. So I think it sounds like it was like three things, right? Born out of the frustration of this is being done in the wrong way, or there is a better way of doing something and I want to do that. I 100% identify with the inability to be managed. That is that has been the bane of my life, certainly all the way through until I started up on my own. And I think there is a certain class or type of person that can embrace that quite easily, and there's others that have a little bit of fear around it. And I think it's about figuring out whether you can actually, you know, take the plunge and back yourself, I think is probably the best way of putting it. And 100%, like, you know, the fact that you got to work with Sam for many years before actually going out and venturing into something, I think can't be underestimated. Like, I mean, I've looked for, you know, employees at different ventures that I've worked with and within my own ventures. And the one thing that is really true in a, I think in a startup is culture matters a huge amount, right? Because if you don't have the right people, then you're not going to have the right venture either, because have a very small kind of pool of people, right? And so why the focus on teenage girls? What drove that? Because I think that's super interesting, especially at the moment where you're seeing, again, more drive towards mobile, you know, distance, COVID, pandemic, lockdown, all the rest of that stuff. But I mean, you were 2 or 3 years ahead of that, right? So what drove all of that?
Yeah, so I think Sam and I had a track record of building for Gen Z. So we'd been, the whole time we were at Blipper, we were building basically Gen Z social networks using AR and computer vision. So we always had an interest in that audience. We had experience with that audience. But once we came out and we started thinking about, okay, like, who can we really make a difference for by building great game content? We just felt, and we could see from the numbers, that the teenage girl market was so underexplored. And then there was also that like aspect of just like, I've gamed since I was 4. I've always gamed my whole life. And I always felt like when I walked into the video game store, that there was such a small proportion of content that really felt like it was for me. There was like, you know, shooting and driving fast on one side, and then like Barbie Princess Island on the other. And then this really small amount of content that I was actually interested in. And, you know, we know that girls are gaming more than ever. So now 84% of teenage girls play video games, and they prefer it to shopping. So when they rank their hobbies, they rank gaming over shopping. So, you know, like, it basically, the intrinsic motivation and quite frankly, the thing that really like gets my goat matched up with what was happening in the market. And we were like, great, like, is there a more perfect opportunity, something that you're passionate about that actually has a huge market potential?
So to an extent, you're kind of creating that market, I would suggest, right, at Love Shark? Because if you say it's that underrepresented, as it were, how easy has it been to gain traction, I guess, right? So one of the things that crossed my mind is that AR and camera games are still probably not quite as well penetrated in the market as compared to console games or PC games, etc. So how has that kind of developed over the last few years?
So I think it's all about forgetting about the technology and thinking about the audience and looking at like, what do they do in their day-to-day life? What are their needs, you know, like online and offline? And then thinking about like, you know, what's their, like, other types of entertainment, analog and digital, and then actually saying like, okay, where could we actually fit into their life? Where can we add value? What themes are they interested in? And then actually using the tech to empower that, I guess. I mean, they're already so active on Snapchat and Instagram. They're already trained in interacting in the camera, TikTok as well. You know, it's TikTok was the app that made it normal for you to put your phone down and stand back and record. Mm. Like before TikTok, people didn't do that. Mm. So they've been sort of training in the UX of AR and video for quite a while. So now it's just our job to actually make it more interactive by gamifying it.
Amazing. So it sounds like, as you say, I mean, like, TikTok is, again, what, 24 months, I guess, the phenomenon, right? So it's an evolution, I guess, from where things were. I mean, again, I mean, probably showing my age, but, you know, I still remember playing, I don't know, like the original Nintendo Game Boy, right? So like, all of this is pretty new for me, irrespective. And I mean, the overall games market is like estimated to get up to like a couple of hundred billion by 2023. Where do you see AR within that? Where do you see Love Shark within that? How do you think that, you know, you're going to be able to take advantage? I mean, it's one of the least well understood, or it's probably very well understood, but it's one of the least talked about, certainly, kind of areas within technology, but it has such a huge, huge kind of value. So, you know, you're kind of flying under the radar to an extent, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I've noticed over the past 5 years is that everything we've known to be true has become true. You know, like, we're just, when you're in a space, you see things earlier, right, than people see externally. So like, that's really helped me to just trust my gut on the direction that things are going. And where I see us, like, we're trying to develop a new game format. So I call it interactive video. So when we talk to, you know, like, our users, we never talk about like augmented reality or machine learning. The tech is just the magic behind the scenes that makes it work. But it's essentially like, Instead of creating, you know, a video or a piece of content and posting on Instagram, people can like or comment. What if you could upload a video and that video is an interactive game that other people can play with?
Oh,
that's what we're actually trying to, that's what we're trying to do. So we're trying to take it from this very sort of like one way interaction that people are having online to something that's interactive and different every time. So it's one of those things that's kind of, it's a little harder to explain it than it is to see it. But I see us as, you know, being the ones that pioneer this new form, this new game format, which is you're interacting and playing around videos of other people. But also, like, we want to be the after school hangout for teenage girls. So,
amazing.
You know, after school, teen boys could go, they go to Fortnite and they're playing, they're hanging out with their friends, they can be creative, they can spend their pocket money. And teenage girls are going to Instagram.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, how is that fair? You know, they like to play just as much as teen boys. You know, they want to interact with their friends. They don't like the negativity that social media brings to them. They, you know, when we talk to them, they, you know, as much as, you know, some of the social platforms can be useful and informative and inspiring, they can also have these like really negative impacts on their mental health. And, you know, there's a lot of like data around the factors that, you know, can sort of like compound that. And if you're just a watcher and a viewer and you're not partaking in the community or interacting, that's actually like far worse for your mental health than if you're someone who's posting and interacting and being an active part. So by making this gamified, we're actually encouraging people to be an active part. And, you know, the hope is that actually building this with all the knowledge we have about what's failed in social media in the past, we can actually build a much more positive ecosystem for them to play and create and be part of a community.
It sounds like a really, it sounds like a really similar kind of, a really similar sort of scenario to say Roblox or Minecraft, I guess, right? But where those are very heavily, obviously, educationally skewed, right? Whereby, to your earlier point, right? It's either fast games, you know, fast, you know, shoot 'em ups, or it's Barbie stuff. And then you've got somewhere sort of hanging around the side, you've got like educational games. And it sounds like what you're trying to do is actually fill that niche for teenage girls, where they have that real desire to both be interacting, to be playing with games that they really enjoy playing with, that are designed with them in mind. And I mean, as a proud father of two teenage girls, I know very well how negative social media can be on mental health, especially over the last 12 months. Certainly, you know, it's been a really problematic kind of issue. So I think that's super cool. And so talk me through a little bit about kind of the scaling journey and the funding journey for Love Shark. I mean, so you've raised, I think, a couple of institutional rounds led by Hoxton. I think you had Index in your last round. Talk me through the challenges there. I think, like, so one of the things that I think I'm really enjoying exploring in these conversations we've been having on this podcast is not necessarily underrepresented founders, but certainly founders that aren't kind of the run of the mill, kind of founders that we see every day that are kind of announced in TechCrunch and all the rest of it. You know, you're female, you're young. You are, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you're of like mixed Scottish and Indian heritage. How did that all play into raising your rounds, or did it at all, or am I just incorrect that these had any impact? Like, what was your journey like within all of that?
It's so hard to know, like, what. Like, what is the factor that makes people say yes or no? Because I think often they don't even know, and it's kind of like quite implicit in the way that they're thinking. I used to dwell on it quite a lot. I think having a Scottish accent does probably like remove, you know, biases that people might have about your ethnicity, because they, you know, they still like, well, I don't know. I've never done a study on it. I have that feeling that maybe the bias is slightly reduced because of that. Have no idea really, but I used to dwell on it a lot, and I stopped dwelling on it once we raised an extremely competitive oversubscribed seed round, and I was like, oh, I can do this. Maybe it was harder. I don't know, because I can't measure myself against everyone else, but now that I've sort of like almost crossed that hill, I push it to the back of my mind because I actually think even though it's really important to have the awareness around, you know, like all the bias that happens in venture, and, you know, the stats are out there. We could see that, you know, people of color and people from like alternative backgrounds are really like underfunded. At the same time, having it in my head all the time
help.
And like having, yeah, exactly. It didn't help me to move forward. So it's like awareness, but then putting it in a box and just, and getting on with it and trying harder and then trying to like pull other people up the rung of the, you know, the rung of the ladder with you. That's how I've just like approached it. But it took a few years for me to get there. When we first started out, it was really hard. Like, it was very hard to raise funding because we were not from game backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Social media was out and games were out. In terms of, like, you know, general VC, social media was very unsexy 3 years ago when we started the company. People wouldn't even look at it. They thought the space, like, that was it. You know, Facebook, Instagram
that was
everything.
It. Right.
Yeah, exactly. The TikTok, the rise of TikTok has actually completely turned that on its head. And now investors are really interested in social media. Same for games. It used to be like, oh, games is a hit business. We're not getting involved in that. COVID's completely changed that. Now every investor is opening up a games team. And then even AR, where we started, that was just as, you know, Blipper was going down. That was when Magic Leap was sort of on the way down as well. So all the investors had this fresh pain from their sort of like failed or failing AR investments. So putting those three things together, plus founders that, you know, that weren't from like a strong like game background, we didn't really get taken seriously at all. And honestly, that is when angel investors just like sort of like saved us and got us started, because you know, they probably didn't have the same level of like critique and maybe pain that the institutional investors had. And we could show them something in their hands that was really fun and really visual that they could imagine the teenage daughters playing. And that like helped us to get those first checks. And then, you know, over the years, we got a little bit more validation. Apple featured us a few times. You know, we started to get data and it got easier from there on. But it was definitely like, you know, as they always are, bumpy fundraising journey.
Yeah, I mean, you said it got easier, but it never gets easy, like, I guess is the point, right? I mean, there's never a founder that I've come across that has said, yeah, that, you know, that fundraise was a walk in the park.
Yeah, totally.
You're always battling against like a number of issues. And so talk me through though, like what, like, so Hoxton Index, was that about the money alone, or was there something beyond the money that they brought to the table that you were really keen to have on board?
Sure. So, you know, debt, like we were lucky enough to have choice when we were making decisions around who to bring on. So we thought very hard about that. Hoxton have invested in us twice. So we've got a long-standing relationship with them. The thing that really struck me about Hoxton when we first started interacting with them was just that I could tell they were very trustworthy. And there were many times along the process where they probably had the opportunity to pull a fast one. And they just didn't do it. And, you know, that was the first thing that really like built trust. And then it's been a case of like, you know, Hussein's been on our board for probably nearly 2 years now. So I've really got to know him as a person. And, you know, like he's proven himself to be extremely supportive, but non-micro investor, which is just, you know, exactly what you want. When it came to Index, I found that they were people that, you know, they saw it, they got it, they believed. You know, which is always good because there was just like an alignment there. They'd invested in like multiple companies who are bridging that gap between games and social. So they've invested in Roblox, invested in Discord. They've invested in a few others in that space as well. So I was like, okay, you know, your portfolio shows that you have a track record of getting this. You know, you've got one of the best brands in the world around VC investing. You clearly love what we're doing. And you know, you do your DD, founder DD, and yeah, I just felt like they're a great match for us, and they've proven to be as well. Again, it's been nearly a year since Index have joined us, and they've been extremely supportive and really helpful. Like if we need information or contacts, they find a way to get it for us because they've got such a global reach.
I think that's incredible. I mean, obviously we've had Hussein Kanji on a fireside last month, and you know, it was a great conversation, and I think I think a lot of what you said there about, you know, that trustworthiness certainly came through in that conversation and in other conversations I've had with him in the past. And I think this is probably why Hoxton punches a little bit above its weight compared to maybe some other firms. But it's incredible that a fund like Index, which is huge, has also kind of backed you to that extent. I think that's I always say to founders that, like, fundraising is not the goal. Like, it's a means to an end for sure. But if you can find the right investors that both believe in you, the team, et cetera, but also can provide the network and all the other sort of things that one would hope to get from a good investor, then that can open up, a huge number of doors. I mean, it's a bit like, I think, A16Z, Andreessen Horowitz and Clubhouse. Like, look what happened there, to your point around social and the whole creator economy, right? It just requires a little bit of nudging from one or two general partners and things can blow up. Where do you see Love Shark heading? What's the next 12, 36, 60 months? Like, where are you going? And where are you going? Where's Tara going within this?
Love Shark, like, from a product perspective, it's a platform play. We want to be, we don't want to be like a game studio that's churning out like hit after hit. I mean, that would be nice, but that's not the model we're going for. We're going to build a place where this audience can come together and interact, and that's going to evolve and grow with them and grow with the technology as well, as we can do more and more things with that. So imagine us, being more of like a Snapchat that's a bit of a hub that has a lot of different things, but you always go to that one place, as opposed to like a King that, is releasing different titles all the time. That's our mission, right? We want to be that after school hangout for teenage girls. Like, that's it. That's what we're trying to get towards. And I think over the next few years, now we're in a case of like validation and soft launch and just like, starting to build that initial small community. As soon as that sticks, it will be a case of, exponential growth, hopefully. This is the product that has huge viral potential, because it's all about creating content that's interactive and then sharing it with others. So, we need to sort of like find exactly the right way that fits into this audience. And when we get there, it's about, putting the fuel on the fire and going crazy. I don't know. Like, I think I manage so many parts of the business right now. Like, I look after product, marketing, finance, ops.
Wow.
I don't know. PR. classic, like founder, CEO. You just kind of do everything.
Yeah.
But I think, over time, there's two areas that I need to focus on. One is product, because I'm a product manager. That's my background, and that's what my my best talent is like really getting to the nitty gritty of product and people and why it works. And then the other side is like people and culture. We've been like, I used to think we were lucky that we managed to get such a great team that was so collaborative. But now that we've now that we're 16 people, and we keep hiring well, touch wood, I think that we're actually, we're getting better at our process, but also like building a culture that when people join it, they learn the rules, they see, how we want to work, and they feel empowered and motivated, and they want to perpetuate that and make it, even better. So I think, in an ideal world, that's the two things that I need to focus on. If we can do that, then I'll be pretty pleased.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing. And I think, as we said earlier, people are central to any startup, especially, right? Like, it's not a massive organization, so there's nowhere to hide. You need to have the best in class, right? And I think, in our fireside with Hussein, someone asked what do they look for in founders? And he said, it's less about the founders, it's about the people that they can attract. And if they can attract great teams, then that's one of the benchmarks that they look at as an example. And I think, 100% trying to focus. I mean, I have the same problem. I'm really bad at a lot of things, but do them anyway, because there's no one else that can. I think that resonates probably with a lot of founders out there. They want to get back to doing the thing that they really love doing and that they're good at doing, and that they know that they can really, add that real value on. So, just as a parting kind of thought, like, what would be your recommendations? I think two, actually, to founders, young founders looking to enter kind of the gaming space and, you know, the AR space, maybe, you know, a combo of both, but also, you know, you want to become, you know, the after school hangout for teenage girls. What would you say to, like, you know, any teenage girls that may be listening right now? Like, I mean, given that, you know, you are going to be up against the Instagrams and the Facebooks and the whatever else, the, you know, the TikToks and the Snapchats of the world, like, how do you bring them over to your side? Like, what's a message that you would want to give them?
Actually, I kind of want to flip that, because what I found is that we, like, so underestimate young people. I think it's just a historical thing. You always underestimate young people. We, you know, we hire, like, ultra young people into the company, and I'm always astounded at how, like, smart and informed they are. And I'm like, I was not like that at that age. So I actually, like, I really try to listen to Gen Z. So we, like, we're talking to them all the time, you know, in our user research. They're part of our Discord. We're getting their feedback on the product. They're the creators on the product. Mm. And the way that, like, I just want to listen to them and, like, hear them be honest about what they need in life, and for us to find, you know, the solutions and the tech to help them. So I don't want to, like, I actually don't want to give them advice. I'd more say, like, can they give us some advice on you know, how we can help them better?
Now I know you're a product person.
Exactly. Listen to the user. And that's what I'd actually say, going back to your first point or first question about, you know, like, advice for young founders getting into games or AR space. It's exactly the same. You have to listen to the users. Like, we've done so many products and so many prototypes that we've thought was so cool, and we test them on users, and they're just like, you know, like, okay, meh. that's kind of fun, or that could be cool if X. Like, you know, you need to see the delight on them. So it's really time consuming and boring and disheartening to just be, like, user testing and user research all the time. But I genuinely think we wouldn't have gotten to, like we've basically started off with something that was very big and messy and chopped branches off, like, all the way, and now we're getting to, like, a bit of a bushy hedge, and there's probably, like, a few more bits to be chopped off, but we're definitely getting there, and that's all come from what our users have told us. So it might be a bit boring, but, like, listen to your users.
Customer centric, I think that's a mantra for everyone. No,
totally
amazing, Tara. Look, I really want to thank you for joining us. Where can our listeners find you? Where's the best place to find you? And Love Shark, is that Twitter, LinkedIn? Where?
Yeah, definitely Twitter. So my Twitter is at Tara Louise Reddy, and the Love Shark one is at LoveShark_IO. That's the best place to get in touch.
Amazing. So look, thanks, Tara. You've been an incredible guest. I'm so happy that we've managed to get you on here. I know you've got a massively busy schedule. To all our listeners out there, again, to Tara's point, like, let us know what you think. What do you want to hear about? What do we get right? What do we get wrong? You know, what are the sort of topics that you think would be great to cover when we speak to more, you know, amazing founders, operators, and VCs operating within the UK European ecosystem? For the time being, thank you so much for listening. You can find me on Twitter. My handle's ADS in UK, equally on LinkedIn. Hope you have a great time wherever you are. Thanks. Okay.